Let's just put our cards on the table. Arjun is your dad. Priya's face slowly reddened more. The tears dripped from her cheeks. Her voice cracked when she said,
My uncle. He's my uncle.
Okay. Then she added,
He is a good man. The best man I know. And I betrayed him.
Cort wanted to console the woman, but he did not reach out to put a hand on her. Instead, he just spoke softly. I've been through all sorts of training to teach me how to keep my mouth shut under extreme stress, even during torture. And I've been tortured in real life. Trust me, there was nothing you could have done. Everybody talks if the pain is bad enough. He thought this would give her some consolation, but he quickly learned it was absolutely the worst thing he could have said. She looked him in the eyes and shouted back,
I wasn't tortured! They barely laid a hand on me!
He cocked his head. But?
The Pakistani man had tied me up, brought in a car battery and cables and water. He told me what he would do, got ready to do it, and then I gave in without so much as a single shock.
Cort waited a moment for the young woman to calm down. She cried openly now, and finally he spoke over her sobs. I'm glad they didn't hurt you. You would have been ruined by it, and you wouldn't have helped your uncle at all. Because in the end, you would have given them everything you knew anyway. And I don't know your uncle, but I promise you, he wouldn't have wanted you to suffer when the outcome would have been the same. She wiped her eyes with her hands. Cort found a kitchen towel hanging at the tiny stove, and he pulled it and handed it over. Priya said,
We need to call him. Warn him. He is stubborn. He has a secured home. He has security. He won't want to leave. But maybe he still doesn't understand the danger he is.
Good idea. She was surprised the American was going to allow her to make this call. Her uncle had double-crossed him. She knew this, and he had to have known as well. When he pulled out his phone, she reached for it hurriedly. Cort held it away from her. Will you do me a favor and put the call on speaker and use English when talking to him?
Why?
I want to hear what is said, he added, by both of you.
You don't trust me?
I don't know you. I know he gave B Company my name. He's not my uncle. Let's just leave it there. She started to protest some more, but Cort was steadfast to the point where she knew she had to drop it, or she'd lose the chance to make any call at all. She took the phone and dialed the number, then placed the call on speaker. Arjun answered hurriedly.
Yes? Uncle?
Priya began to weep. Arjun, to Cort's mild surprise, sounded much more like an uncle and much less like a corrupt broker of killers and gangsters on the darknet. Through instant tears of his own, he replied in English.
Chiki, are you safe? Are you free, my darling? I am safe. Kobor rescued me. He is here. He has asked me to speak English so he can listen.
She continued weeping as she said,
I am so sorry that I told them about you. You have nothing to apologize for, Chiki. Nothing at all. Everything is fine. I am safe at home. No one can get me here.
Cort didn't believe that for a minute, and he didn't believe Arjun believed it himself. Arjun was a dead man as soon as B Company and Khan came for him. He wouldn't call the police. The broker was almost certainly a criminal himself, after all. And he wouldn't try to flee the country. He'd probably already calculated that the drive to an airport or to a heliport or a marina would make him a lot more vulnerable than he already was. No, he'd have to take his chances on private security, and Cort was pretty sure private security would be no match for what would be coming Arjun's way. Cort took the phone gently from Priya. It's Cobalt. What's your personal security situation? The voice of the sweet, nurturing uncle disappeared while he was talking to his contract employee.
I have 4 guards here now. The gate stays closed. I have more men on the way.
There was a pause. Cort realized Arjun was leaving the dead air to convey something about his situation to his employee, something he didn't want to say in front of his niece.
We will be ready for some limited engagement with Khan and his people.
Right, Cort said.
But anything you can do to protect my niece, I will be forever in your debt. I told Khan about you only to save her. She has done nothing wrong.
Do you know where Khan is now?
I don't have any idea. I didn't know he was alive until you told me.
He paused. But I suspect I know where he's going. Again, something was unsaid, but Court and Arjun both knew the score. Khan would be coming to Arjun's house, probably tonight.
Yeah, I was thinking the same, Court replied, then said, Priyanka is safe, and I'll keep her that way. You just need to focus on your situation.
Priya is my situation.
There was a lightness in his voice when he spoke of her that showed Court that Arjun really did care about his niece more than his own life.
Thank you for what you have done.
Then, as before, his voice turned professional.
Anything you can do to stop the aims of Murad Khan, you would have the gratitude of a great number of people.
Yeah, Court said. I'm not doing this for anyone but me.
Priya took the phone back and spoke another minute with her uncle. They both cried, and then she hung up. Court evaluated his situation, then looked to Priya.
Despite what he said, your uncle remains in incredible danger.
I am no fool. I know that.
I'm going to go there tonight, once it's dark. I'll try to help him.
To this, she cocked her head in surprise.
You will?
He didn't want to give the young woman false hope, but he said,
I will try. That's all I can say.
He asked her about her uncle's location, and she told him he lived in a large, secure home in the upscale Malabar Hill neighborhood on the water in South Mumbai. She became more and more animated as she described the building and the security measures there, as if the thin lifeline Court was providing to her uncle was all she needed to have hope that she could save him. Finally, Court said,
I'll try to get him out of there safely, but not till nightfall. They are probably already surveilling the property. It would be a suicide mission if I went during the day.
Her newfound excitement subsided a little, and she looked at him with suspicion.
I don't understand. You are not family. You have no loyalty to me or my uncle. Why would you help him? You were just hired to do a job. Why did you risk your life to help me? Why did you even come to India?
I am helping you both because I am responsible for what happened to you. And I am in India, not just to help you and your uncle, but also to find the man I wasn't able to kill in Pakistan.
The man who interrogated me?
Yes.
Who is this Khan? What did he do?
Court spent the next 5 minutes answering this question. Priya didn't interrupt. She hung on every word. When he was finished, she put her head in her hands. To Court, it appeared she now understood exactly what this man was capable of. She said,
I remember, of course. I was 13 when that happened. All those poor people.
Yeah, Court said. The man I saw the other night, the man you met, was the architect of the entire operation. The one who made it all happen. I thought he was dead.
Court thought a moment, then amended this.
The entire world thought he was dead. But you and I now know that he is not.
She nodded slowly.
I understand why you did what you did in Algiers. But now Uncle Arjun is in danger. He can't stay safe from B Company and Pakistani intelligence in India.
Court said,
If Khan is planning something here in Mumbai, it must be stopped. Arjun gave me up to B Company, but that was just to save you. Still, he might know something about Khan and his plan.
Priya looked at Court for a long time.
No, he doesn't know anything about Khan. I heard them talk. They had never spoken before.
Court said nothing. Priya's chin rose as she realized something.
You are lying to me. You don't need my uncle for information. You need my uncle to catch Khan.
She was young, inexperienced in this world, but Court determined she was an incredibly intelligent woman. He also realized that, at this moment anyway, she was smarter than he wanted her to be.
I will help Arjun if there is any way I can. But if Khan comes after him, that does present me with an opportunity.
Priya nodded at this.
His life is not as important to you as Khan's death. I can see that on your face.
Court looked away. He hated when his true thoughts were so transparent. Finally, he said,
Can you blame me?
She sat up a little straighter in her chair.
After what happened 12 years ago, I agree Khan needs to be stopped before he acts here in Mumbai.
She added,
But my uncle is my uncle. He would die for me, and I would die for him. I am coming with you tonight.
Court shook his head.
not happening.
I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you do, other than obviously kill people. But whoever you are, I doubt you have the skills to slip into my uncle's home undetected, especially if B Company is already there, and see what's going on.
He was suddenly confused. And you do? With a confidence in her voice, she said,
Arjun has been training me for years, since I was a kid. He was Indian intelligence, and he said I would make a good technical support staffer because of my interest in information technology.
She smiled mirthlessly.
He always said it was the safest job in the industry. Anyway, he left R&AW and started his own company, but he said he needed someone with exactly the skills I had learned, and he paid better than the government.
And you learned how to do what exactly? Fly drones? She said,
The drones, that's new. I've done most of my work behind a computer, not in the field. I learned how to break into anything with a computer brain. At first, it was a challenge he gave me while I was in college, hacking mostly. I used to practice on the camera system at his home. I've been in that system easily 20 times in the past 5 years.
Court waved away her comment. If B Company shows up, with or without Khan, the first thing they'll do is cut the video. Priya said,
Arjun knows what he's doing. He has a dummy system. This they will cut. But the main security system is hidden in his house. The cameras are undetectable. He films everything all the time, and I know how to access it if you can get me into his office. I also know how to get around his neighborhood without being seen. Malabar Hill has a lot of cameras. I've spent years walking those streets, identifying surveillance.
Why?
My uncle was training me.
In talking about her value to Court's operation, Priya had regained some life in the past few minutes, now that she saw an objective in front of her. She said,
You'd be an idiot not to let me go.
He answered this with, How long since you slept?
I didn't sleep. I meditated. It's more cleansing than sleep.
Court was dismissive about this. Sleep is all the meditation I need. You too. Let's get 4 hours, then we can build a plan to try to help your uncle.
I'm coming with you,
she said again. I know you are. I need you. Priya nodded, satisfied finally. There was only one bed in the flat, but the woman was small, only 5'3", so she said she'd take the couch. But Court told her that would not be necessary. He looked around the unit, settled on the closet in the bedroom. He moved boxes and shoes off the floor, then took a pillow from the sofa and climbed in. Priya just stared at him in confusion.
Are you a house cat?
Court sniffed the air. No, but I'll probably dream about fish. He shrugged, then motioned to the bed. That's all yours. I like closets. With a bemused look on her face, she lay down on the bed, and both of them fell asleep within minutes. 29. 12 years ago. 25 minutes after Zack and Court left their layup position south of the chemical factory where the massacre had just taken place, the two men drove to the northeast through a heavy downpour. They were in a small Suzuki positioned in light traffic a quarter mile behind a blue Toyota Noah minivan that itself was a few hundred yards behind the three vehicles of the Kashmiri Resistance Front. Lennox, Redis, Morgan, and Pace were in the Toyota, and they had the long eye on the two jingle trucks and the red minibus as the entire terrorist convoy drove ever closer to Lahore. The two vehicles full of Americans were in radio contact with each other, and they worried over the net that they might lose their targets in the city of 11 million people, so the Suzuki and the Toyota alternated the eye position every few miles. But the team made certain to never lose sight of their quarry. Both Omar Mufti and the sacks of material stolen from the chemical plant were in the red minibus, so there was no difficult decision for Zack to make about which vehicle to tail if they split off. No, both his and Lennox's vehicles would stay on Mufti. 30 minutes after leaving the factory, Lennox found himself drifting farther behind the target, indicating that the three vehicles ahead were speeding up. He started to increase his own speed, struggling to keep the big red vehicles in sight through the rain. As Lennox passed a turnoff, however, Jim Pace in the back seat called out to him.
Hey, two! Minibus has exited the highway. It turns south. We just passed it.
Shit.
Lennox said.
I didn't see it.
He continued on while radioing Zack behind him. A half minute later, Zack and Court Suzuki pulled off the highway at the same exit where Pace saw the minibus turn, and they caught sight of the red vehicle as it rolled down a congested road to the north. The rain fell in sheets now, and both Court and Zack struggled to keep the target vehicle in sight as they made their way down the four-laned avenue filled with motorcycles, scooters, cars, and trucks, many of which were red, and all of which were in the way. Omar Mufti's minibus was thankfully still in view through all the rain on the windshield, so they stayed on it for several blocks, closing to within 30 yards. The weather conditions, while making it harder to see the target vehicle, provided a net benefit to the followers. It would be literally impossible for Mufti and the men with him to pick out a tail through their rearview mirrors, and looking out through the back window to identify a specific car would be nearly as difficult. After a few minutes of winding travel, they followed Mufti as he turned on Naziria-e-Pakistan Avenue, and the rain began to slacken considerably. Zack slowed the Suzuki, dropping back a few more car lengths just to be sure he couldn't be sighted. There were billboards everywhere, an orgy of commercial advertisement. Beautiful women in full makeup modeled clothing of every conceivable color. Furniture, watches, soft drinks, everything was advertised dramatically, sometimes garishly, from huge elevated signs. This was clearly some sort of shopping district, and people were everywhere, even in the rain. Up ahead, the minibus slowed and made a left turn into the drive of a three-story building. The gate at the entrance opened, and the minibus rolled through. Zack continued on past it. Fortunately, the traffic was such that he had to creep by at a snail's pace. He and Court saw two men, already in the forecourt of the property, sliding the metal gate shut just after the vehicle entered, but the men wore raincoats with hoods, and neither Court nor Zack could make out any facial features at all. As they passed by, Court read the English language sign on the building out loud.
Hotel Days Inn, no vacancy.
Sounds charming, Hightower said, and he radioed Lennox, letting him know where the KRF men had stopped.
He continued down the street, looking for a place to observe the location from a safe distance. Court said,
That hotel looked dead in the parking lot. I don't think it's even open.
They pulled into an ungated lot, parked with their nose facing Naziria-e-Pakistan Avenue, and Court pulled his binos out of his pack. Looking over the location from 50 yards away, he said,
Definitely shuttered and dark.
Zack surveyed a digital map of the area on his phone.
There's a one-lane street behind it. I'll vector Lennox over there, see if he can get on a rooftop and take a look down over the wall. If he can set up a video feed, we can back off till Hanley tells us what to do.
Court said, In the meantime, I'll make a pass by the front gate, try to get a shot of anything or anyone visible through the bars. If they start offloading that AN, that would be good info to have.
He began reaching into his pack, looking for something. Zack grabbed him by the arm.
On foot? You want to just walk by on the sidewalk?
Why not?
Too easy to get compromised?
Court chuckled.
I got this.
He pulled a black poncho out of the pack, began putting it on.
Come on, Zack, Hanley put me on the team because I can do shit like this in my sleep.
Hightower relented.
Okay, on this side of the street, not over there. Keep the hood of that poncho covering your face.
Court opened the door.
Don't worry.
As he climbed out, Zack called after him.
And don't do it in your sleep!
Even in what was now a moderate rain shower, there was significant foot traffic around Court as he headed up the sidewalk in the direction of the hotel. Women in traditional shalwar kameez passed by, umbrellas in hand. He passed a corner shop offering ice cream and juices, a fabric retailer, and a small cluster of street stalls selling various types of dupattas, the long, colorful veils worn by most women in the nation. Men, mostly in modern clothing, walked around or rolled by on scooters and motorbikes, and kids followed their moms into and out of shops on both sides of the street. This felt like a reasonably upscale and safe area to Court, though he knew that some of the men who'd just killed dozens in a nearby town were right now in the middle of all the peace and tranquility. Court pulled his cell phone out as he strolled along, looking at it as if checking for a call or text, but he took the opportunity to turn on his camera and zoom it in to the maximum setting. He then lowered the device in his left hand, careful to keep it more or less hidden from view to anyone across the street.
If Mufti had posted sentries in the upper windows of the hotel, they might well spot him taking photos if he was obvious about it, so Court endeavored not to be obvious about it. A corner barbershop was directly opposite the hotel, and Court slowed to look at the signs on the glass. The writing was in Urdu. He didn't have a clue what any of it said, but he took his time window shopping for a haircut, with his left hand down at his side and his phone filming the location across the street behind him. After 30 seconds, he moved on, past a man standing under a tarp in front of a big metal fire pit grilling sweet potatoes, and he walked a full block to the west. And then, despite Zack's orders that he keep his pass confined to the far side of the street, he crossed to the same side as the target location. The rain had lessened a little more, and he noticed most men weren't wearing raincoats at all now. He took the opportunity to pull off his poncho and drop it on the ground next to a garbage can, where he was certain it would be picked up by a passerby in seconds. And then he headed back up the street. He crossed in front of the gate to the hotel with a purposeful stride that matched most everyone else's around him, and in so doing, acquired upside-down video of the hotel and the entrance to it by holding his phone in his left hand and orienting the lens in the right direction. Court didn't even glance into the property as he passed. He just continued on, crossed the street down at the end of the block, and made his way back to the parking lot. Once Court sat back in the passenger seat of the Suzuki and closed the door, he said,
"Did you realize we were parked at a fertility clinic?"
Zack looked over his shoulder, saw that the sign said Sakina Fertility Hospital, and then turned back to Court.
"I fucking told you not to cross the street. I know what I'm doing, boss. So do I. And even if I didn't, I am your TL. So you do what I fucking say. You follow my orders, or we are going to have issues, Six. You got that?"
Court looked at Zack, fought a little eye roll.
"Got it. Now how about we look and see if I captured anything?"
Hightower remained angry, but the two of them looked at the video, flipping it upright first, then stopping it and moving it frame by frame as it captured the inside of the hotel property through the vertical bars of the metal gate. There were five people visible inside, but two faces were obscured by raincoats. The images of the others were blurred in most of the frames, and most of the ones that were clear enough didn't reveal any faces. Mufti's white shirt was visible as he stood out of the rain in the covered parking lot that made up the ground floor of the building, which was raised on stanchions, with a staircase in the middle heading up to the hotel. On video from Court's second pass by the hotel, he again advanced the images frame by frame. About 45 frames in, shortly before he lost sight of the inside of the property, he'd caught a single image that he thought might prove to be useful. Omar Mufti stood, his back to the camera, and in front of him were two other men, facing right towards Court's lens. Their attention was on Mufti, and their images were fair. One man was small, with a bushy mustache. He was in his 20s and wore a long brown kurta. There was a slight smile on his face. Next to him, almost shielded by the back of Mufti's head but not quite, was a man in his 30s, with short dark hair parted to the side. He was taller than the man next to him, but shorter than Mufti. Court said,
"Any idea who these clowns are?"
"Negative," Zack said. "But I didn't see either at the chemical plant. They might have been waiting back at the hotel."
Court said, "Too important to get their hands dirty on the raid, maybe?"
"We're not analysts, kid," he added. "Vance and his team can get these images cleaned up enough for facial recog. I'm sending them to Rooster right now."
Court said, "What do we do in the meantime?"
"Something you're gonna do a lot of."
"Wait."
"Yep."
Zack pulled out of the fertility clinic to go find a large parking lot someplace where they didn't have to worry about being compromised by the KRF.
30.
Matthew Hanley sat in the ultra-secure, sensitive compartmented information facility in the main CIA building at Camp Chapman, staring at a monitor on a wall and waiting for a video feed to be initiated. He had the images just sent from his ground branch assets in Lahore queued up on his laptop, and he could share them with the other participant of the video conference in real time as soon as the other attendee arrived on the call. Hanley was hoping to get lucky, to bypass the time required to send the images back to Langley for evaluation, and to get an answer on who these men were, right here and right now. From what he knew of the man with whom he was about to speak, It was very possible he might recognize the two unknowns at the hotel where the Kashmiri Resistance Front brought what analysts had determined to be just under 2 tons of material suspected to be ammonium nitrate. Chief of CIA Station Islamabad, Ted Appleton, knew a staggering number of players here on the Indian subcontinent, but even if he didn't know either of the men, Appleton and his station could get to work on the images and possibly get him an answer faster than the analysts at Langley could. Hanley hoped their hunt for the identities of these men would be something of a moot point soon. Omar Mufti and the suspected explosives were both on site, and Hanley had already sent this information to Denny Carmichael at SAD, who would already be on the phone to Greg DeFalco, Deputy Director for Operations for the CIA. DeFalco would in turn go to the director, who might or might not need to go to the president for the green light to send in Ground Branch. Hanley thought it likely that he was going to get the raid he wanted today, but he would need Appleton's help to pull it off. He wasn't sending Zack and the others in with handguns. Non-official cover agents in country would need to deliver weapons and body armor for the lightly equipped American team in Lahore, and Appleton could make that happen easily, or he could slow the process down. Hanley needed for this to be a good, productive video conference to grease the wheels in order to make the next few hours go smoothly. But he harbored serious concerns that today's hurriedly arranged meeting would be instead somewhat confrontational in nature. He didn't know the chief of station in Islamabad personally, but everyone at the agency who had been around since the beginning of the war on terror knew a lot about him. Appleton had risen through the ranks in a 23-year career that had taken him all around the world. He became deputy chief of station in New Delhi, running assets that earned him acclaim and eventually promotion. And then he was bumped up to his current office in Islamabad. Serving in both India and Pakistan made Appleton a go-to when expertise on the region at large, the conflict between the two nations, or the players involved was needed. The feed initiated finally, and a graying man in his 50s, wearing a suit coat but no tie, looked into the camera with a serious face that made no attempt to hide his annoyance. This looked like bad news to Hanley, and any residual hope Hanley had of this convo going better than he expected evaporated just as soon as Appleton spoke. "I recently heard that I have cowboys running around on my range, and you, I am told, are their trail boss." Before Hanley could reply, the station chief said, "I understand the need for ground branch ops all the way over in the Fata. I don't like it, but I get it. Islamabad station has less influence over there in no man's land along the Afghan border. But in fucking Lahore, you have your door kickers running around all the way on the eastern side of the country? This is my turf, Hanley." This wasn't the first time Matt and his team had ruffled the feathers of a station chief by running a mission in their area of operations. It didn't really faze the big former Green Beret. He just patiently waited for the chief of station to finish his opening rant. Appleton added, "I don't blame you, of course. You're doing your job. I just wish Carmichael would keep you guys out of here so I can do my job." Now it was Hanley's turn to talk, and Hanley knew how to play the game at CIA. If he acted contrite in any way, Appleton would see it as weakness, and he'd push harder against any further ground branch ops in Pakistan. So instead, Matt Hanley just smiled a little and said, "First, thanks for the meeting. Sorry to pull it on you so fast. Second, if Lahore is in fact your turf, you must certainly be aware of the mass execution of dozens of civilians this morning at a chemical plant in Serai Mughal, 25 miles southwest of the city." Appleton showed surprise on his face, and Hanley continued, "A chemical plant that produces ammonium nitrate for fertilizer and for industrial explosives. Approximately 4,000 pounds were stolen, we have estimated, and then driven into Lahore in the last hour." Appleton was speechless. After a brief pause, Hanley said, "Near as I can tell, Ted, you've got yourself a new terrorist organization nobody had ever heard of 6 months ago, and now they're snatching enough ammonium nitrate to blow up half of downtown Islamabad. That's your turf today. So how would you say you guys at Islamabad station are doing right now?" He imagined Appleton was seething, but to the man's credit, he remained professional. "It was the Kashmiri Resistance Front?" "Correct. Mufti is on site at a safe house with the explosives right now." "Send me everything you have." Hanley said,
I will. I definitely will, because I need your help. You aren't taking over control of...
Hanley ignored the station chief.
First, though, I need to see if you can recognize a couple of other personalities at the target location.
Without waiting for a response, he clicked the images on his laptop in front of him and sent them to the skiff in Islamabad. Appleton put on his eyeglasses, an air of annoyance in the act. Then he clicked on the images and peered closer. As he did so, Hanley said,
"The man with the white shirt, the one with his back to the camera, is Major Omar Mufti. We don't know who the other two are."
Hanley was looking right into the station chief's eyes on the screen as they widened to their full extent. Then the man lurched back in shock. The ground branch group chief immediately questioned the station chief.
"Who are they?"
But Appleton did not answer. He just stared.
"You obviously recognize them, Ted. Who are they?"
In an almost hoarse whisper, Appleton said,
"I'm going to have to get back to you."
There was no denying he saw something that shocked him, but it seemed as if Appleton didn't want Ground Branch to know what he'd seen. But Matt Hanley wasn't having it.
"Stalling now isn't going to do you any good. I've already requested approval for a task force raid on this safe house. We've got the second in command of the organization in pocket, along with enough explosives to cause a hell of a lot of misery."
Appleton began shaking his head while Hanley spoke.
"No, absolutely not. You cannot send armed Americans into that location. You have to stand down." "Now why would I do that, Ted?" Because this needs to be handled delicately. Trust me, my guys are incredibly delicate when they need to be. Headshots only. We wouldn't want that AN to go boom, now would we?"
Hanley knew that wasn't what Appleton meant, but he was goading him on.
"You can't do this," Appleton stammered. "This is a diplomatic matter, not a..." "Diplomatic?"
Hanley barked in surprise.
"What? You want to seek UN condemnation? Is that it? Shit. Where I come from, there isn't anything terribly diplomatic about a group of terrorists with bomb-making materials."
To Hanley's surprise, the mild-mannered-looking Appleton shouted now.
"Those are not terrorists!"
His face reddened as he yelled, as if he were on the verge of experiencing a cardiac event. Hanley leaned forward in his chair. In a measured tone, he asked,
"Who are they, Ted?"
Appleton let out a long sigh, then leaned forward, closer to the camera, his arms on the desk in front of him. Seemingly defeated, he spoke quietly now.
"The man on the left, the younger one, I don't know him. We'll run the image. But the other, the man on the right, his name is Murad Khan."
The name meant nothing to Hanley.
"And what is Murad Khan, if he's not a terrorist?"
Appleton leaned back in his chair.
"He's ISI.
Now Hanley sat back in his chair as well.
"Well, shit. He's an officer in FCU, the Foreign Coordination Unit." "How do you know of him? FCU is pretty covert, from what I understand."
Appleton shrugged, rubbed his ruby-red face.
"We have a source. That's all I'm prepared to say."
He hesitated, then added,
"I also know something else about him. Which is, he's Kashmiri, originally from the Indian side. A Muslim, he was snuck over the border to Pakistan as a boy."
Matt Hanley looked at the image on his laptop now.
"A Kashmiri terrorist with ties to the government."
Slowly, almost reverently, he said,
"Well, hello, Pasha. Nice to meet you." "Wait a second," Appleton said. "That's jumping to one hell of a conclusion. We don't know if he's the leader of anything, much less the KRF. He could be running an op against them. You don't have a clue what the ISI is up to." "He's not running an op, Ted. He's running the show. We don't know what their plan is, but we do know it involves mass murder and a couple tons of ammonium nitrate. We don't know Khan is a terrorist."
Hanley added,
"Once my guys get there, he's going to look a lot like a terrorist to them. I can promise you that."
Appleton said,
"If the U.S. kills Khan right there in the middle of the KRF, we will get fallout like you wouldn't even believe." "You're talking politics, Ted. I'm talking something else entirely."
Appleton was almost begging.
"Look, Matt, I've got a source who can find out what Khan's status is currently with ISI, what he's working on. That intel is the clarity we need."
I just need a couple days to connect with my source so they can get the intel and get back to me.
Hanley replied,
You don't have a couple of days. I've got a team of ground branch shooters a mile away from a terrorist safe house, a dirty intel officer, and bomb-making materials. My guys have real-time images of the location. I have everything I need to hit that building and end this bullshit today. Matt. And I'll get the approval, too. You know I will. The best thing you can do is hunker down and get ready for any diplomatic consequences that come our way after. I know I'm making your tough job tougher, but you know this is the right call. If Khan, Mufti, or the AN make it into the wind while I have a team in position to intercept them, then that would be on me, and I'm not gonna let that happen. Matt, just a day. Give me a day, and I can... I'm notifying Carmichael that there is an ISI officer on site, but I'm reasonably sure this will change nothing. We're sending a priority request to your station to provide my men with some small arms and equipment for the hit. I'd appreciate that happening before the sanction comes through. That bus full of explosives can leave at any time and disappear into the second largest city in Pakistan. Hanley added, which is, as you mentioned, your turf. Matt, listen to me. This is bigger than terrorism. This is international relations. You cutthroats in ground branch don't get to make policy. Watch us, Hanley said, and then he ended the feed with the press of a button. At the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan, 52-year-old Ted Appleton rubbed his hands through his thinning hair, pushing sweat down the back of his neck, then sat up straight and resolute. He left the skiff, closed the door behind him, retrieved his phone from a locker, and headed up the hall. He stepped into a restroom, checked to make certain no one else was inside, then locked the door. He dialed a local number and sat back on the vanity, his eyes skyward as if he blamed the heavens for what he was about to do. After several rings, a woman with a Pakistani accent answered in English.
Hello?
Yes, Appleton said.
Sorry to bother. Is this Mejid's phone?
There was a slight pause.
You must have misdialed, sir.
My apologies. Did I dial 4730? Another brief pause.
You did not.
Have a good day, Appleton said, and he hung up the phone with a shaking hand. The woman on the other end of the line was codenamed Leopard, and she was the source who had given him every bit of intel about the KRF and the inner workings of the ISI. His call told her that he needed an emergency meeting. The two digits at the beginning of the string of numbers that he'd asked her if he dialed indicated where they would meet, a code indicating a park 15 minutes drive from the embassy. And the second pair in the number, 30, indicated that she only had 30 minutes to get to their prearranged meeting location. She would be both frightened and furious, this Appleton knew, but he also knew how important it was that she dig into Murad Khan immediately, before Appleton's own organization killed the very source his agent was using to find out about the KRF. 31. Present day. Court and Priyanka arrived well after sunset in the Malabar Hill neighborhood where her uncle lived. They walked along a leafy street within sight of the ocean back down the hill behind them, and Court marveled at the beautifully landscaped gardens, the large stately homes, and the peace and quiet here, especially considering they were at the southern tip of otherwise chaotic and congested Mumbai. 7.5 miles away was the locality of Dharavi, the largest slum in Asia, with a population of over 1 million. But here, looking around, Court saw that these people were living large. He leaned closer to Priya as they walked. Your uncle worked for the government? She seemed annoyed by the comment and the obvious inference behind it, that he was involved in something illegal.
He used to. Then he started his own business, as you already know. Remember, you worked for him?
Yeah, but...
He did well for himself. There is no law against that.
Then she shrugged.
He never told me that he was doing anything underhanded. He knows I wouldn't have worked for him if I knew he did.
Court dropped it. To him, Arjun was just another shady broker in the world of contract agents, hitmen, and thieves.
but to the woman walking along stiffly now, he was family. Many of the homes were gated, but many were not, relying on incredibly thick, almost jungle-like vegetation to secure the property. Occasionally, cars came up or down the lightly traveled two-lane road, and Court and Priya would step behind some piece of foliage in case B Company gangsters were on their way to, or on their way back from, Arjun's house. They'd made it most of the way down to the location Priya had indicated on a map, and then, without a word to Court, she turned off the road and began walking deeper into vegetation at the edge of the yard of a large yellow house. Court caught up with her, took her by the arm.
"Where are you going?"
"There is a back way."
She motioned to the house.
"The man who lived here died in May. The home is for sale. I am sure there are still security cameras and motion lights, but I don't think there are guards. We can get to the rear of my uncle's property if you follow me."
This made sense to Court, and he trailed behind her as she began pushing again through leafy palms. He was unaccustomed to having a guide lead him to a target, but his plan to creep up to the front entrance and kick in the door seemed like the much weaker strategy now. Court first saw the home where Arjun Bhandari lived shortly before 9 p.m. There were lights on around the property, close to the main house, and lights on inside the building, although sheer blinds made it impossible to see inside. Priya started to move closer to the two-story white house now, but Court stopped her.
"Give me a second."
"To do what?"
"Look, listen, smell."
She remained quiet next to him for the next couple of minutes. He detected no movement inside through the large windows, nor did he hear any noise beyond the natural sounds of a residential neighborhood.
"Something's not right," she said. "There should be movement. He said he had 8 guards and more on the way. Where are they?"
Court thought to himself that it was pretty obvious they were too late, but he didn't say this.
"I'm going in. I'll text you when it's clear."
"I'll come with you."
"You'll stay right here."
When she started to protest, he said,
"I promised your uncle I'd keep you out of danger. Just wait for me to check it out, and then I'll text you."
Court left her there, then moved across the back garden slowly, with his pistol low in his right hand. She watched him disappear, then heard nothing for the next few minutes, other than the sounds of leaves and branches rustling in the breeze from the nearby bay. Eventually, she saw lights being turned off in different rooms, until the entire rear side of the home went dark. Finally, her phone vibrated, and she looked down at the message she'd received.
"Come in."
She rose and began moving forward, her legs trembling, terrified of what she would find. Court was standing at the back door in the darkness when Priya appeared in front of him. Her eyes were wide. It was fear. It was apprehension. He had seen these emotions in enough people over enough years to recognize them easily. And for her part, the Indian woman seemed to do a good job reading his face. She asked,
"What is it? What did you find?"
Court answered softly,
"I'm sorry."
She started to cry, keeping her sobs as quiet as possible.
"He's dead."
Court nodded. He gave her just a moment, then said,
"He's in the living room. Members of his guard force, too. It looks like someone disabled the main camera system. I found the computer in the room off the kitchen where the feed was being sent, but it's full of bullet holes and the hard drive is gone. I don't know where the other is located, so I'm going to need you to go inside and check that."
She knelt down in the doorway, her face in her hands. He could tell she was doing her best to be strong, but clearly she held herself responsible for her uncle's death. He gave her a few more seconds, but only a few.
"We've got to move. If there are recordings of tonight somewhere, we need to take a look and then get out of here."
Without a word to Court, she stood and passed him by, wiping her eyes. He looked out over the darkened backyard, made sure he didn't see any movement there in the shadows, then turned and followed her in. She stepped through the living room, having the presence of mind not to turn on one of the lights that Six had just turned off. She moved slowly, using the light that filtered in through the thin blinds over the floor-to-ceiling window facing the rear garden to make her way over to the dead men on the floor. Arjun Bhandari was in the center of the living room, stripped from the waist up, sitting in a kitchen chair with his hands tied behind his back. His legs were splayed out, his head back, his nose and chin jutting towards the ceiling. Court had placed a kitchen towel over Bondari's face. Nevertheless, even in the low light, the blood showing through it and the wounds visible on his bare arms made it obvious he'd been tortured. Four men, surely hired security officers, lay dead on the floor nearby, face down, as if they'd been executed. Court wondered if there were more dead outside on the grounds. Priya stepped over to her uncle's body. Court moved to stop her from removing the towel, but she just placed a hand on his shoulder, then leaned over and kissed Arjun's forehead through the towel. Court was sympathetic, but his prevailing emotion was one of urgency. They had to get whatever intelligence they could from this location and then go. He felt bad about the prospect of hurrying her along, so he was glad when she rose back up and began walking again, picking up the pace as she made it to the circular stairs. Court followed her up to the second floor, then into Arjun's office. He flipped a light off here a couple minutes earlier as he cleared the home with his pistol, so he knew the space was empty. She walked to his desk, sat down like she lived here, and accessed his desktop computer. Within seconds, she had the application that controlled the security system open. After a few seconds more, she said,
"The covert system is still operating. They didn't catch it."
She tapped some keys. Court stood behind her while a dozen or more camera feeds appeared. He saw the live image of the death downstairs and hoped the woman wouldn't focus on this horrific image, because that would only slow them down. To her credit, Priyanka stayed on mission. She clicked the mouse and began sliding it, drawing the time backwards on the cameras as she did so. Slowly at first, and then more rapidly. Other than their arrival, there was no movement on the camera at all in the last half hour, meaning Arjun had been dead at least that long. But when she started to go back farther, he knelt down next to her.
"Maybe you should wait outside. Let me do this."
"I'm already upset. I'll be fine,"
Court said. "I think it might be better if I watch this alone."
"You don't speak Hindi."
"Khan is Pakistani."
"He speaks perfect Hindi. Trust me, I spoke with him."
She asked,
"Have you?"
It was a rhetorical question, but she definitely had a point. He doubted there would be a lot of intel derived from what was said during the interrogation with Arjun, but he didn't know for sure. He nodded, then steeled himself to witness a young woman watch a close family member die brutally. She stopped scrolling back and then typed 1500 into a box on the screen. When she hit enter, the cameras showed the light of day. Arjun Bhandari was alive. He walked around the house, speaking with armed guards, looking out windows. This was well after Priya had escaped, and after she and Court had communicated with him, so at this point the man knew what he was up against. He spoke on his phone from time to time, but Court didn't want to be here in a house full of dead guys for any longer than he had to be, so he asked her to keep advancing and not to translate his calls. 4 p.m., 5 p.m., everything looked the same. There seemed to be about 8 armed guards around the property, and Arjun was clearly paranoid of an attack, but otherwise the scene around the home was unchanged. And then, around 6 p.m., a pair of new guards showed up. They wore the same black polo shirts that the other 8 or so men Court counted around the property wore. They went and spoke to Arjun briefly, as well as one of the other guards, and then they went back down to the secured iron gate. Something about them piqued Court's interest. He asked Priya to select the camera showing the front gate. It was apparently positioned high on the front wall of the home, and she advanced in 8 times speed. The two men talked to the other guards there for a minute, and then something happened. But it was so quick, neither Priya nor Court could tell exactly what it was.
"Oh my God,"
she said, and she backed up a minute, then watched the event in normal speed. All the guards were equipped with submachine guns, but when the first two men's backs were turned, the new guards pulled knives from under their shirts, rushed up behind their unsuspecting prey, grabbed them both by the mouth, and drove the blades hilt deep into their backs. Priya gasped. Both dead men were dragged quickly into the tiny guard shack and dumped there. Apparently, the killers pressed the button to activate the gate, because it soon began to slide open. 2 sleek Mercedes V-Class vans rolled into view and pulled up the driveway, and then the gate was again shut. Priyanka deftly switched camera views to the front door feed. This camera was hidden in a light fixture right above the door, and by viewing it, they could see 10 men piling out of the 2 vehicles, suppressed submachine guns at the ready as they charged forward, splitting off into different groups, each with a sector of the property to clear. Switching to the foyer camera, Court and Priya watched 2 guards attempt to engage the intruders, then drop dead from silenced subguns before they even fired a shot in their defense. The attackers flew through the living room. Priya feverishly changed views to try to keep up with the action. 4 shooters ran up the stairs, and she switched views to Arjun's office, the room the 2 of them were now in. Arjun was here, standing behind the desk exactly where Court now stood. He pulled a pistol out of the drawer, stood up straight, and put the gun to his head. Court himself wouldn't have hesitated. He would have known what was in store for him if he was taken alive, and he would have much rather gone out on his own terms than on the terms of Murad Khan. But for some reason, Arjun tossed the gun to the ground and raised his hands, just as the 4 attackers filed into the room. He had to have known he'd just given up the only easy road, and for the life of him, Court couldn't understand why he'd not just put a bullet in his brain and saved himself the pain.
"Why didn't he do it?"
Priya asked in a cracked whisper, and Court admitted he had no idea. There were more engagements on the property, but because of the suppressed weapons and the knives used by the attacking force, the other guards were, without exception, caught unaware and unprepared. Court didn't see a single gunshot from any of the private security force Arjun Bhandari had trusted with his life. Finally, there were only 4 guards left, all inside the home. They were surrounded, and they surrendered without firing a shot.
"You can't get good help these days," Court thought, but he didn't say it out loud.
Even though Court already knew how this show ended, he cursed at the men for giving up their guns, because now those 4 men were all face down on the tile downstairs, with holes in the backs of their heads. Arjun was led down the stairs, his hands lashed behind his back with flexicuffs brought by the attackers. Then he was sat down on a kitchen chair that had been dragged in. The guards were placed on the floor next to him, and then the gunman just waited. Finally, Murad Khan entered the room from the front door. Court looked at the digital time readout on the feed and saw that this happened less than 90 minutes before he and Priya had arrived at the home. Court clenched his fists, but he kept his eyes on the screen. Softly to Priya, he said,
This will be more difficult to watch than you can possibly imagine."
To this, she just said,
"Trust me. Right now, I wish you spoke Hindi."
"Yeah, maybe I can find another translator and we can take the..."
"Stop talking, please,"
she said, and she turned up the volume. Over the next several minutes, Priya relayed the conversation to Court, Khan asking Bhandari over and over about the American who saw him in Algiers and the identity of the person who hired him for the job. Arjun kept repeating that he didn't know, but he thought both parties were working for R&AW. This wasn't good enough for Khan, however, and Arjun Bhandari was tortured mercilessly, both by Khan and by henchmen ordered into action by Khan. The Indian broker's hands were shattered. His face was pounded by a fist wrapped in a bathroom towel. Cigarettes were extinguished on his arms and neck. Court looked down at Priya while this was going on and saw that she had averted her eyes. Still, the wails from her uncle had to be having an incredible psychological impact on her. Court could hear in Khan's voice, finally, that he was beginning to believe the Indian, and to Court this meant the end was coming soon. One more attempt to elicit a different answer came in the form of a long kitchen knife, its tip turned red hot by putting it on a gas stove, being placed against the side of Arjun's face by one of the B Company goons. Bhandari's head thrashed from side to side. He screamed over and over. Priya wasn't looking, only listening with her head in her hands. And when he screamed a final word, she fell to the floor, sobbing. This was the only word uttered during the interrogation by either man that Court understood.
"Priya!"
Court left her alone while he watched the end. Khan took the long knife, came closer, and knelt down in front of Arjun, who at this point was as beaten and spent as Court had ever seen anyone in his life. Khan spoke, and Priya, though on the floor fighting off hysterics, retained the presence of mind to translate. Through tears, she said,
the name of the person who hired you, or we continue. I swear to you, if you give it to me, I will end things fast.
Court saw Arjun's mouth move, but he heard no sound. Neither did Priya, apparently, because she'd translated nothing. Khan, on the other hand, seemed to cock his head to the side. Hurriedly, he moved closer, up to Arjun's ear, but in so doing, he covered the view of the camera in the wall to Arjun's face. Khan shouted, and Priya translated.
Again!
Khan was demanding Bhandari repeat himself. Whether or not Arjun responded to this, Court couldn't tell. He couldn't hear the man's gasping whispers any longer, and he couldn't see the man's face with Khan in the way. But then, to Court's astonishment, Khan stumbled back like he'd been poleaxed. He recovered after a minute, though he'd continued to look unspeakably distressed. Then he lifted the knife higher in his right hand, took a single step forward, and slashed the Indian man's throat without another word. Blood spurted. Khan turned away, giving Arjun Bhandari no more of his attention, and then he began walking out of the front door without speaking to anyone. Court got a last glimpse of his face as he did this, and he could see obvious worry, almost panic, in his eyes.
What the fuck was that all about? Court muttered to himself.
He stopped the video when everyone left in the two vans. Priya had regained some control over her faculties, and she sat on the floor now. While wiping her eyes, she said,
"He has a safe over there, hidden behind a panel in the wall."
"Do you know the combination?"
"Of course not. He kept that very private."
Court didn't think Arjun's safe would contain anything relevant to his mission, but he still went over and popped open the panel. A 3-foot-high and very secure-looking combination safe sat there, apparently undisturbed. Safe cracking was almost impossible without skills, tools, and time, none of which Court possessed.
"We've got to get out of here," he said, and he took Priya by the elbow, then started for the door.
She took the hard disk from the computer, securing the record of her uncle's murder as well as the record of her and the man she knew as Cobalt's presence, and slipped it into her bag. She followed him back downstairs, back through the living room, past the bodies, and then back outside, into the dark. Court expected that the police wouldn't find this gruesome scene until the next morning, but when they found it, they would look into Arjun's past with the intelligence services and pull out all the stops trying to find out who was responsible. 10 minutes later, he and Priya walked through the dark residential neighborhood down the hill towards the Nepean Sea Road in hopes of hailing a cab there. They were both alone with their thoughts for a minute or two, and then Priya spoke.
"I need a laptop, better than yours. There is a place open all night near the apartment."
"Good," Court said, and he handed her a wad of cash.
"What will you do?"
she asked as she took it.
To her surprise, Cobalt had an answer. "When we get back to the fish market, I have to make a phone call. I know a guy who might be able to point me towards someone who could help us. It's a long shot, but I don't see any other options."
"This is a friend of yours?"
"A colleague I trust. He knows people, and he knows things," she said.
"Well, I need to go shopping. I'll buy a couple of laptops, some other computer equipment. I'm no good with a gun. If I am to be of any help, I'm going to need all my gadgets."
32. 12 years ago. Fatima Jinnah Park is a large green space in north-central Islamabad, just 15 minutes' drive from the U.S. Embassy. CIA Station Chief Ted Appleton took regular walks in the park, normally during his lunch hour or right after work. Flanked by 4 CIA plain-clothed security officers who knew to stay far enough away from their protectee, but vigilant to the surroundings nonetheless. There were playgrounds, mosques, prayer areas, amphitheaters, and other structures in the park, and even a massive cricket ground, but it was also an intercity forest of dozens of acres, intersected by footpaths and little paved roads. Appleton wasn't here because he liked the exercise or the air. He was purposefully unathletic, and the smog in Islamabad was thick and oppressive, but he'd been coming here regularly to establish a baseline pattern of life for anyone who might be interested in his movements. The curiosity of anyone following him would be piqued if the American CIA chief randomly drove to a park and walked deep into the trees. It wouldn't take a master spy catcher to deduce something was afoot. But Appleton had been to Fatima Jinnah Park over 100 times since he'd arrived in country, so anyone curious about him would have long since lost interest in his regular journeys here. The four security men had fanned out on the footpath, deep in the woods, listening to the last of the Salat al-Asr, the afternoon call to prayer, blare from the speakers in the mosque on this cloudy afternoon. Appleton was there as well, and while this was just a normal day at the office for the Armed Protection Force, for Appleton, this was personal, and his hands trembled. He pulled a tiny radio from his pocket and clicked the transmit key.
"Neil, push your team back another 25 yards. I don't want my agent seeing anyone." "Sir, we won't be much use 75 yards away from you. Just do it," he snapped, then made himself relax a little. "Please."
"Yes, sir,"
the leader of the security detail said. In seconds, Appleton was, as far as he could see in any direction, the only person here standing on the footpath. But not for long. A woman approached from the east. She wore a shalwar kameez with a blue and gold dupatta covering her hair. She was in her 40s, beautiful, stunningly so. Deep brown, complected, with dramatic eyes and full lips. Her eyes locked on his form the moment he saw her, and Appleton knew why. She was searching for any indication there was some emergency, some trouble that meant she was in imminent danger here. There were strict protocols established by Appleton to meet with this agent. These protocols had kept them both safe in 3 cities, in 2 countries, for well over 6 years, and Appleton had thrown them all out the window today for this hastily arranged meet. She was quite visibly and quite understandably concerned now, though they had used the established emergency meeting code. When she was in earshot, he fought the urge to call out and assure her she was fine. Instead, he waited until she walked all the way up to him. Her eyes showed fright, and her gait and posture reflected the tension she felt. He tried to relax her with his soft tone.
"I'm sorry to make you come today, Emil. I know it's irregular."
She asked the only question he would have expected her to open with.
"Have we been compromised?"
"No."
Appleton shook his head.
"You are safe. I told you I'd never let anything happen to you."
"So, then, why did you—"
Appleton interrupted.
"Did you hear about Lahore?"
"The chemical factory. Yes. My office is collecting data on it now. But the camera recordings were erased, and there were no witnesses left alive."
"You told me the KRF was just going to perform reconnaissance on the location."
"That was the information we had. Our intelligence was that they were just going to surveil it for a follow-on force that had not yet been assembled. They weren't supposed to attack it."
When Appleton seemed to be looking for his words, she said,
"What is it, Ted?"
Appleton shrugged. He didn't want to reveal this, but he trusted his agent implicitly.
"Well, we had a team in position to watch the entire event."
"What?"
Her voice conveyed anger and panic.
"You told the CIA about the factory?"
"Of course I told the CIA. That's how this all works. But that's not even the problem."
"Maybe not a problem for you. You get a feather in your cap for being right. Makes you look like the star that you are to them. But it's a problem for me, isn't it? I was one of a very limited number of people with access to that intelligence. FCU will do a review to see where that leak came from. They might find me."
"You will be fine. The agency team wasn't compromised. Nobody knows they were there. Yet."
"Yet? What's happening?"
"The CIA team, they are in Lahore now, and they are about to attack a building where the chemicals were brought from the factory. There are somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 KRF personnel inside the location now."
Leopard had known Appleton for many years. She knew there was more he had to say.
"And?"
"And there, right now at the location, with Omar Mufti and the other KRF fighters, is a man who has been photographed. The photograph has been shared with me, and I presume that by now, it's also been shared with headquarters."
Emil's eyes narrowed.
"What man?"
After a look around to the bushes to reassure himself they were alone, he said,
"Murad Khan."
Emil looked at Appleton like he'd suddenly grown a horn on his forehead.
"What? What are you saying?"
Khan, we think the man you have been working closely with is, in actuality, Pasha the Kashmiri.
That's impossible. All the intelligence I've given you for the last 6 months about Pasha and the Kashmiri Resistance Front was acquired by Director Khan and his agents in the field.
I know.
Why would he be giving us...
Think about it. What has he given you?
Nobody had ever heard of the KRF until Khan's source in Kashmir revealed their existence. ISI implicated them in a series of attacks in Quetta, in the Fatah, and even over the border against the Americans in Afghanistan.
After the fact.
After the fact, yes. We don't have real-time intelligence on the KRF. Not yet, anyway.
Okay, go on.
Khan's own confidential agents revealed that the organization's second-in-command was a military officer who flew helicopters for the Army Aviation Corps. I was the one who went through dozens and dozens of names before finding out that Major Omar Mufti, a Kashmiri, had been away from his post during two of the attacks in the Fatah and one of the attacks over the Afghanistan border.
What else?
She thought a moment.
Peshawar. Khan's office found out Mufti would be in that military base south of Peshawar, in advance, and I notified you.
Appleton just nodded. This was another busted mission, and she saw on his face that he felt the intelligence Khan had given her had been tainted. Emil had been a Pakistani intelligence agent long before she became a double agent for the Americans. She had been doing this for 20 years, long enough to know what Appleton was thinking now.
It's not disinformation, Ted. It's good, solid, actionable intelligence.
Appleton nodded distractedly, still thinking.
I've been feeding this to Langley for months. They've been frustrated at every turn, and the KRF is growing stronger and bolder. Now they have a ground branch team ready to go in against Khan and the others.
Khan is not with them. If he is there at the KRF safe house, then he is undercover. He has to be.
A department director who goes undercover.
Emil sniffed.
Look at you, Ted. How many station chiefs meet agents in the field? Quite a few, I'd imagine.
Appleton sighed.
Well, if Khan's not dead in the next few hours, I guess I need you to find out what this undercover mission is all about.
She shook her head.
No, Teddy. We must warn him.
Appleton cocked his head.
Warn him? Are you crazy?
Obviously, I can't call him up and say, Sir, the CIA is outside, run. But surely there is something we can do that will stop your agency from going in and making a massive mistake.
There are 2 tons of ammonium nitrate and a dozen or so mass murderers in that hotel right now. Going in and ridding the world of the threat of both would not be a massive mistake.
Her eyes filled with anger and mistrust.
So you agree? Khan should die?
Appleton had disappointed her, and their interpersonal dynamic meant that he felt the sting of her judgment like a stiletto in his heart.
He said, No. I need to know more about him and what he's doing, but it looks bad. It looks very bad.
Then let me find a way to stop this CIA attack. You do nothing. I will take care of it.
She put her hand on her heart.
I will make Khan my mission now. Find out what is going on.
Appleton softened further.
That's dangerous. If he is Pasha, then you need to be doubly careful.
I'm a double agent. I'm always doubly careful.
The two of them stood there on the footpath for another moment, just looking at each other. The meeting had already lasted too long, and they both knew it, but still, Ted Appleton could not break away.
Emil, I need to hold you, to kiss you.
There was fresh emotion on her face. Appleton assumed his face revealed the same. She said,
In public? You are literally violating all our protocols, aren't you?
We are not in public. My security team is out of the way.
He stepped up to her, took her in his arms, and pulled her close. She gave to him willingly, and they kissed. He felt her tears on his cheek. The tears were from fear, or from longing. He didn't know, but he knew he had to protect her, just as he knew that sending her back to the ISI to dig into Murad Khan was essentially throwing her to the wolves. Softly, he said,
I love you.
She put her head on his chest. The veil covering her hair brushed his chin.
I love you. How much longer?
Appleton forced a smile.
Not much longer. You and I will leave all this, retire to Mumbai, and you will have your family and your safety, and I will have a cozy teaching job, and we will grow old together.
She sniffed back a sob.
I am growing older already, without any of that.
Patience, my little leopard. Patience.
She nodded, then pushed away from him gently.
I have to go. Where is this place in Lahore?
Appleton told her, and he told her that he had officers on their way to deliver weapons and body armor to the small American raiding party. He made her promise to be discreet. Emil fed him intelligence from Khan, which made Khan, as far as Appleton was concerned, his best asset. He would protect his asset. He would fuck over Matt Hanley and Ground Branch to keep his best asset producing, but if he found out that his best asset was a terrorist, feeding him doctored intelligence to lead him off track, well then, Appleton knew what he'd do. He'd get Emil to safety, and he'd rain down hellfire on Murad Khan. In the meantime, however, Matt Hanley's hellfire was perhaps only moments away from raining down on Khan, and this they had to stop. With another rushed kiss, Emil walked off, continuing down the path, and Appleton himself headed off in the direction he'd been traveling. As he walked, he radioed for his men to close down on him for the moment to the waiting cars. But his thoughts were somewhere else. They weren't on Khan or on Hanley or on some nameless, faceless, knuckle-dragging good old boys from Ground Branch. No. His thoughts were on the woman he'd just kissed, the smell of her perfume that lingered on his clothes, the schoolboy-like shivers he got whenever they were together. Even like this, even working, even while discussing life and death and the fate of fucking nations, the thrill of being with her, holding her, staring deeply into her soul, had never subsided in the least. Appleton had met the woman who had been codenamed by the CIA as Leopard when she was a mid-level 38-year-old ISI operative working non-official cover in Mumbai, India. Her work was against the Indian financial sector, making contacts and social engineering them to provide her with information about economics, the strength of certain nationalized businesses like Air India, as well as the petroleum, shipbuilding, banking, and coal industries. She was good at her job, but a senior CIA case officer named Ted Appleton uncovered her. The agency decided not to report her existence or activities to the Indian government, but to instead approach her in an attempt to flip her to work for the CIA against her home agency, the ISI. Appleton himself made the initial contact, and over the next year, she began giving him small tidbits of intel from ISI regarding operations against India. The CIA, in turn, fed her information about Indian nationalized businesses. Nothing too destructive to the Indian economy, but ultimately, the CIA was looking out for America, not for India. Soon, Emil Vaziri, codenamed Leopard, was promoted to New Delhi, where she worked for ISI developing relationships in diplomatic circles. She flatly refused to work with anyone at CIA other than Appleton himself, so he was promoted to fill the open deputy chief of station position. Their professional relationship was 1 year old when their personal relationship developed. One evening during monsoon season, after a stressful ISI operation in New Delhi, Emil Vaziri came to Ted's apartment for a clandestine meet. She needed a shoulder to cry on, and Appleton provided that shoulder. They slept together that night. Ted was conflicted about what had happened. He knew it was wrong. But the 46-year-old bachelor also knew that he had fallen in love with his agent months before their first kiss, and he was powerless to fight it. For 2 years, they worked and lived and loved in New Delhi. She received more and more intelligence from the CIA that she used to bolster her position in the ISI, and then she was recalled to Islamabad. Now she was in charge of liaising between the analytical side of Pakistani intelligence and a small but powerful department on the operations side, the Foreign Coordination Unit. In this position, she saw almost everything that had been collected by FCU, and she had some operational details of their activities. She worked closely with a 35-year-old FCU section chief named Murad Khan, a rising star at ISI, much like Vaziri herself. Soon Appleton was moved to exploit his agent in her home country. He was made chief of station in Islamabad, but he still ran Leopard, and he still loved Emil. He promised her they would go back to Mumbai someday, walk the haunts they used to walk, and get married, but only after the War on Terror, in which her organization had a large part to play. Leopard had first alerted the Americans to a new Kashmiri separatist group with aims to attack American interests in the region for supporting both the Pakistani government and the Indian government. The separatists were enemies of their own nation as well as India, and soon enough, America was dragged into it. Leopard's intel put the size of the organization at somewhere around 500 fighters, but while this was nowhere near the strength of many other terror groups in the region, the fact that the KRF attracted former military personnel to its ranks made it an organization to watch. Ted Appleton thought about all this on his way back to his office, but mostly he thought about Emil, the danger he put her in, her intense love for him that caused her to do what he asked, and the risk they were both taking now, knowing that a senior ISI chief was possibly running a terror organization with the means to cause true damage to American interests in the region. He felt a chill across his body, and he was only able to calm himself by thinking of the plans he and Emil had, after he retired and after she defected. That day was coming. He just had to believe. And now, he just had to find a way to keep Emil on the inside for a little while longer. 33. Present day. The independent state of Papua New Guinea comprises half the island of New Guinea, just north of Australia. It is the most rural nation on planet Earth, with less than 14% of the population living in urban centers, and it is one of the most unexplored parts of the world, with many uncontacted tribes living independently in the western portion of the nation. The U.S. Embassy of Papua New Guinea is, however, right in the middle of a small urban center overlooking Fairfax Harbor in the capital city of Port Moresby. To call this a backwater posting for a CIA officer would be insulting to backwaters everywhere. It was one of quite a few agency stations where careers went to die. If you were a brand new and shiny 24-year-old CIA case officer and you were stationed in Port Moresby, then everyone knew you had underperformed in your training and you were being punished. But you could, potentially, dig out of this hole and work your way back into the CIA's good graces. If you were a senior officer with the agency, however, serving in your last decade before retirement, and then you were relocated to Port Moresby, then everyone knew you were fucked, and most everyone probably figured that you had it coming. 58-year-old CIA Chief of Station Matthew Hanley had only been posted here a couple of months ago, sent by the director as retribution for an operation he'd conducted sub rosa, and in the intervening period he had plenty of time to reflect on his sins while swatting bugs and approving cables for transmission to Langley that no one would ever bother to read. Despite the station's reputation, he came to New Guinea certain this was just a bump in the road in his career and he'd make it back up the ladder soon enough, but now he wasn't so sure. He lay in bed at 2 a.m., wide awake and staring at the ceiling, wiping a sheen of sweat off his thick neck and high forehead every minute or two, because the temps outside, even this late at night, were in the 90s, and the air conditioning here in his home on embassy grounds couldn't handle it. This was a day like any other for Hanley, or so he thought, until his landline began ringing. He snatched the phone up, knowing it would be the night duty officer in the station, because no one else used the landline.
Vaughn.
Sir, sorry to wake you.
Hanley hadn't been asleep, but he responded grumpily.
Yeah?
There's a call for you. It's a blocked number. We can investigate if you want us to, but he said...
Send it through.
Hanley wasn't expecting a call, but he wasn't sleeping, and his brain wasn't shutting down anytime soon. He heard a scratchy line, thought the user might be using voice over internet or some other means of hiding his location.
This is Hanley,
he said, trying not to get his hopes up that this might be something interesting. He heard a voice he recognized well.
Hey, Matt.
It had been months since Hanley had spoken to Court Gentry, and there were a lot of reasons for that, not the least of which being that Hanley's organization, the CIA, currently had a kill order out on the former agency assassin. Gentry had been on the run since the op that got Hanley himself booted out of the deputy director for operations position, and for all Hanley knew, Gentry could be anywhere now and working for anybody. Hanley looked at his alarm clock quickly.
I was just about to brew some coffee. You got a number I can call you back on?
Hanley wouldn't talk to Gentry on an embassy line, and Gentry would know this, so Gentry would definitely have a secure number set up. Hanley wrote it down when Gentry gave it, and then